You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. Mr. Chief Justice, I'd like to please reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal, if I may.
All right.
My name is Chuck Slamp. I'm here on behalf of Floyd Howard, who has joined me today with his brother from Buchanan County in far southwest and very snowy southwest Virginia. I'm afraid that we may have brought the snow with us, Your Honors, and I apologize for that. Maybe the hot bench will melt it. Your Honors, this case is all about one thing. The principle that if you don't ask, you can't receive. And that's where I want to spend the bulk of my time. That's the subject of our first assignment of error. And because of that principle and that longstanding rule of this court, we believe that that demands that this court reverse the judgment of the trial court and send it back to reinstate the first opinion order that gives the relief sought by the plaintiff in the first complaint. Your Honors, the principle of if you don't ask, you don't receive has been discussed by this case numerous times in cases that are far too numerous to mention. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
We actually have a seventh justice who's going to sit on this case.
Counsel, I don't want to deprive you of even a second of your argument.
Thank you.
The court's going to take a very brief recess. Don't go anywhere.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Turn that clock back to 15, if you will, please. All right. You may proceed again.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, I'm Chuck Slemp, again. I'm here on behalf of Floyd Howard asking this court to reverse the judgment of the trial court. I'm joined with Floyd Howard, who's come from Buchanan County, and we ask that this court reaffirm the longstanding principle that if you don't ask, you can't receive. That principle has been decided by this court and set down from this court in case after case, dating all the way back to the early 1900s and most recently in 2006 with the Monahan case. And that principle is issues in a case are decided and based upon the pleadings, not the witnesses, not the evidence, no matter how convincing, no matter how overwhelming, it's the pleadings that count.
But if this were an ejectment case, would adverse possession be an affirmative defense?
Justice Kelsey, it would.
Would it need to be pled?
Your Honor, we believe that it would, based on this court's decision in the Deal case, Harris versus Deal, 1949 ejectment case, that this court said, and I'm quoting from the court, a court has no jurisdiction to act outside the limits of the law or beyond the pleadings. Now, there are some cases, the Bradshaw case, the Christian case, some early cases, 1916, that suggest that maybe you could just plead the general issue of not guilty. We submit, our opinion is that those rules have been abolished when this court adopted Rule 3-8 that says police to the general issue have been abolished. And then this court has said various times in other cases police to the general issue are abolished. The primary mechanism of pleading, of asserting a defense is through a pleading and answer. That didn't happen in this case. And in this particular case, if you look at the Potts versus Matheson case, in 1935, this court said a decree cannot be entered without a pleading upon which to found the same. And if it's entered, it's void. That's what happened. No pleading was asserted by the defendants saying that we assert adverse possession. They didn't seek to amend it. They didn't file a cross bill. They didn't They asserted it for the first time at trial, saying that this is our evidence for adverse possession. And the plaintiff objected, saying, you can't do that. You didn't plead it. Rather than asking to amend, rather than asking to follow the rule, the statute 8.01-377 variance statute to continue and allow them to try to postpone the trial and file an amended complaint or answer, that didn't happen. They just went forward with the case, and the trial judge got it right the first time. It voted for us before he voted against us. Essentially, the trial judge said, you can't do that. And then later reversed himself, basing the decision on the Bradshaw case and the Christian case, which we submit is not the best decision.
Well, I know you say that it ought to be an affirmative defense. Let me ask you this. Wouldn't it more appropriately be an affirmative counterclaim or cross-claim?
Yes, Your Honor.
As opposed to an affirmative defense?
Mr. Chief Justice, yes. That would be the best way to do it. I suppose if you would want to plead it as an affirmative defense, I guess you could do that too. But essentially, that's what you need to do, is say counterclaim. You believe the boundary is here. We believe the boundary is here because of adverse possession. But instead, what the defendants did in this case, the plaintiff said, we believe the boundary is here. And the defendant said, we believe the boundary is here. 1905D. Rather than saying anything about adverse possession, this middle line somewhere, they said 1905D is where we need to be. And that's on page 4 of the appendix in the answer. Paragraph 4 of the answer sets forth the 1905 deed and denies what the plaintiffs have alleged as their boundary line. And so...
But why can't a defendant say to a boundary dispute, say, look, I'm not interested in a deck action in my favor, but I can tell you it's not where he says it is.
Right.
Isn't that available to a defendant in this kind of action? Is it necessary to assert an affirmative claim for relief?
Justice Kelsey, that's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to, according to...
So if you just asserted it as an affirmative defense, negating the plaintiff's claim of the boundary line location, and you're not asking for any relief yourself as to a counter-declaration, you're saying it's not where he says it is, why would it need to be pled in that instance?
Well, the judge in the trial court cannot base his judgment upon something that's not been pled. That's what this court is... repeatedly said.
Can you help me out with Monahan, which said that mitigation was an affirmative defense, but because the context of that kind of affirmative defense, it wasn't always required to be pled, and it depended on the circumstances?
You're right, Your Honor. It does depend on the circumstances. For instance, at trial, if we, so to speak, open the door and say that as was done in the Monahan, one of the cases, there are some exceptions that are discussed in Monahan. And some of the exceptions are, if we open the door to a defense, if something becomes apparent at trial that that's a defense, based upon something the plaintiff did, he was put on notice, then sure, you can assert that as a defense. But that didn't happen in this particular case. Your Honor, this rule is so strict. If Your Honor looks to...
The objective of an affirmative defense is to preclude surprise and prejudice.
Correct.
To the extent that there are only three ways that one can resolve a boundary dispute, one would be establishing an unbroken chain, the other would be establishing title by adverse possession. What is the surprise or the prejudice when the opposing party says adverse possession at trial without having affirmatively pled it?
Justice Powell, what it is... essentially, if you're preparing for a trial and you are essentially... Let me use the farming analogy.
You might not want to do that.
Well, for instance, I grew up in a tobacco...
For God's sake, don't do sports.
you say you're planting corn, and as a farmer, you're prepared to produce a harvest of corn, and then 9 months later, when you get ready to reap your harvest and you're expecting potatoes... You might be a little misled. You should have planted potatoes if you were expecting potatoes. Likewise, in a situation here, before the trial, if you're expecting to reap a harvest of this is my boundary versus this is my boundary, That's what you should sow. Galatians 6:7, whatsoever a man sows, that shall he also reap.
What about this? What about when you sow soybeans, but then you see corn sprouting up all over the
place?
I mean, why wouldn't you harvest the corn too?
Well, Your Honor,
you saw it coming.
Moving away from the bountiful harvest, Justice Lacey.
I'm really wondering if we aren't talking about semantics here, although they may be very important semantics, because in this type of a proceeding that was your responsibility, your burden, to prove that where the boundary line was.
Exactly.
And when you file that case, there are a lot of different ways that the defendant may or may not try and show that you're wrong, that your chain of title was wrong, whatever. But you know you are on notice that you wouldn't be in court if they agreed with you. So when the trial court issued its final opinion, he decreed that the boundary line submitted by the defendant is the proper boundary line. Isn't that just another way of saying that the plaintiff has failed to prove that the boundary line is as the plaintiff claimed?
Your Honor, Justice Lacey, I think what's important to note here is the previous opinion. The previous opinion, His Honor, Judge Johnson said, the plaintiff has met its burden in showing, you know, these boundaries didn't close, these points on the map don't close, so he did meet his burden, showing by preponderance of the evidence that the boundary is here.
On the other survey.
Because of the survey, and we had the surveyors testify, and I was not trial counsel, so I can't speak to the details, but essentially the trial judge said, you've met your burden, and then reversed himself saying, well, while you met your burden that you believe the boundary is here, we're going to allow this adverse possession claim over here because now it's available to him, even though the trial judge didn't specifically point to a rule of this court.
Well, but the trial court actually, he does say that you didn't contest the evidence by the defendant that he adversely possessed the disputed property, and you agreed that you were never in possession. Nothing in this order specifically says that the trial courts hold that he proves that he owns the land by adverse possession. It merely says that the boundary line that he said was the proper one.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the reason I'm saying that is perhaps going back to a couple other questions, is that in these kinds of actions, you've got the burden, right, to prove it.
Right.
And if you don't prove it, for whatever reason, you lose. To say that the affirmative defense in this case defeated your proof, maybe one way to put it, but another way is to say that now it's his land, and he didn't have a counterclaim, is that correct? I mean, he didn't claim that. He didn't say, I own the land, you don't.
Right.
But it seems to me that the trial court just merely said you didn't, in its second order, the evidence just contradicted your evidence, and you didn't win.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, that's the first opinion letter said we did win. The first opinion letter said you did prove it. And so I think.
But there are motions to rehear all the time.
There was a motion.
And judges do change their minds.
Sure.
Even some of us change our minds.
But there wasn't a change of mind based on any precedents. The change of mind was based on Bradshaw case that I've explained in my brief isn't on point for the principle that the judge cited.
But I think the point you might be missing in the answer to your question is when the judge first looked at the state of the record, he purposely excluded from his consideration the adverse possession facts. Forget claims, counterclaims, whatever. Just the facts, the adverse possession facts.
Mm-hmm.
On his assumption that it had to be pled and he would commit error by considering the facts, right?
Right.
So as just been asked of you, when the judge is looking at the whole thing from scratch and the judge sees all these facts that were in the record, and tell me if I'm wrong on this, it wasn't objected to.
Your Honor, if you look at page 58 of the record, or 59 of the appendix, it was objected to. However, below it says he just didn't contest that evidence. I think that's the point. We did object to the presentation of the defense of adverse possession. We didn't counter that. We didn't present any other evidence, but Howard did say you can't.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but that's not on appeal, is it? If the trial judge relied upon evidence that you objected to,
right,
and you're not appealing the reliance, that's a separate question, is it not?
I may have misspoken. What on 59 of the appendix, it states we objected to the defense of adverse possession, to them presenting that claim. Our position was essentially, if they want to present that claim, let them. But a trial judge cannot find any facts without the pleadings based upon it. That's what this court's precedent says. And so, based on that, let them present that. We object to it. We object to that defense. Because Your Honor can't find in that favor, they didn't plead it. And essentially, that's the rule.
Well, counsel, isn't there a distinction between affording any relief mm-hmm. on a claim not pled, as opposed to considering facts that are in evidence on the major claim, on the primary claim, which is your claim, that
sure.
has been. And you did not object to the evidence, as the court said, that satisfied related statutory requirements.
Because it was not available to the defendants.
No, but you didn't object to the introduction of any of that.
Let me ask you a quick question. You can sit down and think about it and answer it on rebuttal, all right?
Yes.
If we accept your view of this case, that mm-hmm. the boundary line dispute has this legal issue and is limited to these facts,
mm-hmm.
and you prevail, what would keep your opposing parties and counsel from then suing affirmatively for adverse possession after the opinion is handed down? Think
I'll
about
wait.
It.
Yes, sir.
1 minute.
May I ask a question before he sits down? It goes back to the first question that Justice Kelsey asked you about ejectments.
Yes, sir.
You would not have to, would you agree you would not have to plead adverse possession in an ejectment action?
Our position is you can't, or you must, based on Harris versus Steve. And that the previous rules that leads to the general issue, which were permitted by the Bradshaw case and Christian, have been abolished after the adoption of the rules.
If I disagree with you that they have been and you would not have to plead adverse possession as an affirmative defense in an ejectment, would you then concede that you likewise would not have to plead it in a boundary line dispute?
No, Your Honor, they're different proceedings.
What about the fact that Brunswick Land and Bull Run both say that the same principles of law applicable to ejectment are applicable to established boundary line disputes?
That is correct, Your Honor. While they are the same principles of law, we also have to distinguish that these are two different types of proceedings in their nature and two types of proceedings in their posture. And based on and because of those things, there are different requirements of proof, there are different requirements of the pleadings, and we would submit Harris versus D says you can't base a judgment upon something that was not pled. A trial judge is without jurisdiction to do that. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Eugene Compton from Lebanon, Virginia, and I represent Leslie Ball. This is a unique position for me. I'm normally representing the appellant when I get up here. And this feels a little better. Let me just start out. I think that the real crux of the issue was stated earlier. The question is whether or not the appellant had notice of the boundary line as claimed by the appellee. And there can be no question that the appellant had notice. If we are, and this court says that we are a notice state, that our pleadings are for the purpose of putting people on notice, she was on notice that the Balls were claiming the boundary line as the location that the judge finally issued a decision saying that it was. That's why she brought the suit. And that brings the question up also as to whether or not adverse possession should be treated as a substantive claim or a procedural claim. If it's substantive, then it could be raised at any time. If it's procedural, it may have to be raised at the beginning. But in this case, also before I forget, let me say that what I discuss, I'm still relying on my brief, so I don't want to waive anything that's in the brief. But
may I ask you this?
Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
Counsel, let me ask you one question.
Yes, sir.
If it seems to me if you're a plaintiff and you go in and think you're going to try a case based upon deeds and surveyors, surveys and so forth and plats, and then you find out that the defendant is really claiming adverse possession, it's a whole different kind of evidence that's going to be considered. Shouldn't the plaintiff be aware that that's going to be involved in the case?
Well, in a case where the deeds are all consistent, that may be correct, but this is a case dealing with land in Southwest Virginia that calls for dogwoods in 1905, and they're not there. There's nothing there. The only thing that's there is the ridge.
I guess my point is, I'm going to bring a surveyor in if I think I'm going to be talking about surveys, but if I think you're going to be talking about how much time you've been on the property and what you've done on the property, I want to bring in my neighbors to perhaps contest that. And they wouldn't be relevant in the first proceeding process.
Well, actually, she could have done that, and I think that the question still is whether or not it's substantive or procedural.
Okay.
And I believe that adverse possession is substantive. She knew she had a problem with possession because that's why she brought the suit, or the appellant brought the suit. There was a problem with possession. There was a fence that was built pursuant to a survey in 1957 using the same deeds that were used by the surveyor that did the survey in 1996 who confirmed the survey of 1957. The appellee had no reason to think that he would have to rely entirely or even partly on adverse possession. He'd been in possession of the property. A boundary line fence had been built. There's no question that all of the evidence that was presented at trial indicated that he was claiming under his deed, she's claiming under her deed.
You just said the appellee had no way of knowing he would have to. Did I understand you correctly to say the appellee would have no way of knowing he would have to argue about adverse possession?
No, ma'am, what I meant is that he would have to rely exclusively on adverse possession because the pleadings were based upon deeds.
And that's Justice Millett's question, mm-hmm. I think. I don't want to put words in his mouth.
Oh, please go ahead.
But the pleadings were based on deeds. So how would the plaintiff know that I do need to bring in my neighbors and everyone who can say how long they've been there or not there? How would they know they need to bring that evidence in?
Because the fence had been there since 1957, I guess would be my response.
Is the fence where your client was alleging the deed line?
That's correct.
Deed line was?
That's correct, Your Honor. And the basic premise that is on the that the appellants are basing their title on is that none of the deed descriptions close. Not hers, not the Howards, not the Balls. They don't close. The original description of the property did not close. So what we had is we had two live surveyors. There had been three surveys. Two surveyors testified at trial. Both had performed surveys for the appellant, and one, without knowing of the previous survey, came up with the same identical line. Found a pin at the beginning of the fence that went up the ridge and surveyed that line, which conformed to a boundary line fence that had been there since 1957.
Mr. Compton, I hate to interrupt you, but
yes,
I do have a question. In this case, a statutory line drawing, boundary line case, the only relief that was requested was by the plaintiff to establish a boundary line consistent with the allegations in her complaint and the survey she relied on. In the relief granted in the order, the trial court did not think that the plaintiff met her burden, but does not simply deny that relief. In the order, he states that the boundary line submitted by the defendant is the true boundary line, but then goes on to say that the plat shall be recorded in the clerk's office, basically showing that ownership and using that line, which in effect gives you a undeniable ownership in the disputed area. Now, and again, perhaps it's a semantic issue, but it seems to me that the only relief that was asked for in this case was put the boundary line as where the plaintiff wanted it. The trial court didn't do that, and in fact denied that, but went further. And this order would say that that the trial court in fact awarded you ownership of this property, relief which you had never requested.
Actually, Mr. Ball in his pleading did request that line be established pursuant to the deeds, and he was relying upon surveys that had been performed. I'd like to also point out, and the plaintiff bore the burden of proof. There were, again, three surveys. There's also several divisions of this property. The first one was in 1905. When my client's predecessor entitled his great-grandfather, and I mistakenly, I think, in my brief mentioned grandfather, it's his great-grandfather, acquired the property. They had actually been in possession of this property for over 100 years when this suit was filed.
I understand that, but I would like to know where in the plaintiff's, in the defendant's pleading, he asked for that description. He says that he affirms the descriptions are accurate in the best of his knowledge, and that the paragraphs allege the property line also state disagrees with the description provided by the plaintiff. I'm looking for the place where he asks for an affirmative relief declaring that it is his property, not the plaintiff's.
What he did is disagreed with the allegations that were made by the plaintiff that she owned the property on.
And that occurs in every case, right?
Pardon me?
And that occurs in most cases where the defendant says, I disagree.
That's correct. And in this
case, judgment in my favor, which means she did not meet her burden of proof.
That's correct.
Not necessarily that the land is mine.
Well, we would argue, Your Honor, that she did not meet her burden of proof. And that's the problem. I cannot answer for the trial judge and when he wants it, but when we went to trial, there were, as I said earlier, three surveys, one of which was done in 1957. And as a result of that survey, a boundary line fence was built between the two properties. And at the time of the 1996 survey that was also done for her, it was referred to as an ancient fence. I suppose that he would have no reason to think, going into court with that type of proof, that the judge may initially say, well, I'm going to agree with a third.
So let me give you a hypothetical, if I could, for a second. Let's say you've got these two people living next door to each other, and one of them has a boundary, has surveys and so forth that show a certain plot of property into his name, and the other one has a certain property going into his, and there's actually a gap in between the two.
Mm-hmm.
And if we have what we had here now, the plaintiff asks that you confirm that he owns the gap, and the court says, no, you don't own the gap. That doesn't automatically mean that the defendant would own the gap.
That's correct. But in this case, there was no gap. There was a boundary line fence.
But the logic still applies, and this is what's so esoteric about your seemingly simple case. As has been just asked, you could respond to a boundary dispute by saying, they say that's where the line is. I'm telling you, that is not where the line is.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want you to fix any other line. I just want you to deny their claim that that's where the line is. And if I were a defendant, I might have a strategic reason to say, you know, I'll bring my own action later, as mm-hmm. The Chief's question alludes. And I'll fix it when I'm good and ready, when I have my witnesses ready. There's no compulsory mm-hmm. counterclaim, so I'm not going to get hosed on that. As Justice Lacey's question pointed out to you, that's not really where this case went. This case went to basically a de facto counterclaim of sorts, fixing a line that was later going to be recorded in the land records pursuant to the defendant's claims, as opposed to merely denying the plaintiff's claims. Surely that's got to have some significance to the question we're now asking about the propriety of pleadings.
Well, I think the question can be answered by stating that adverse possession is a substantive claim that can be raised at any time. and pardon me. And I believe that that is the case, because if it were an ejectment action, they could raise it at trial. And if she had brought an action saying, you're on my property, which is what she tried to do by having a declaratory judgment action, get off, he could have raised it at that time, at any time. And I guess that's the question, and it's an interesting one for the court.
But there was never a request to amend the answer, am I right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So no one said, Your Honor, I don't think this is the way it works, but obviously there's zero prejudice. He had actual notice from the beginning of discovery, and I apologize for my pleading mess up, but I'd like leave to amend in the alternative if you think this needs to be amended.
I don't, Your Honor, but it would have been helpful if we had.
If the judge had granted that motion, that hypothetical motion, then all of the actual notice arguments you make would be very persuasive. But do those actual notice arguments really apply when there's no pleading? There's no affirmative pleading of the affirmative defense if one is required?
If an affirmative defense has to be pled because it's a procedural matter, then that's the question that is before this court, I presume. Is it procedural or substantive? But there's another question that's before the court. Whichever way you decide this case, as far as the requirement of a pleading, the result can be sustained because the appellant did not meet her burden of proof as to where the boundary line was.
But that would require a modification of the trial judge's order. We'd modify it on order of remand, would modify it to withdraw the reestablishment based upon the adverse possession issue.
If you decide that it's a substantive claim that can be raised at any time, then that's probably true. But isn't that the state of the law basically in Virginia, with being able to raise adverse possession in an ejectment action at any time?
Well, counsel, let me ask two questions. First of all, in the ejection action, it's a defense to being ejected from the land. It is not necessarily a ability to state that you own the land. There are a lot of that in an ejectment, the action is brought to get you off their land because we have better possession. And you can use adverse possession as a way to say, you can't get me off this land.
Mm-hmm.
In that order, the order doesn't say you own the land, the defendant owns the land. It says the plaintiff doesn't get to eject you. So that's a different, if you want to analogize the two cases, types of cases, that might be the correct analogy. But in this case, it looks like the trial court said, first, in answer to just with regard to what Justice Kelsey asked, the plaintiff did meet her burden. And here, and the boundary line is what the plaintiff says it was. That was his first thing. When he came back as an affirmative defense, he didn't say the plaintiff didn't meet her boundary line. It was, this may be what she owned, but by adverse possession, I'm saying that now you own it. So it isn't a matter, how could it be a matter of simply a defense? It's an affirmative grant as opposed to a defense to the plaintiff's claim.
I would try to answer the question by stating that possession is obvious. If it's obvious to the plaintiff, in this case it was obvious to the plaintiff, then it should be able to be raised at any time. And I would cite the court to its case of Hackleford versus Linkus, which discussed the necessity of being able to prove either by actual notice or constructive notice that there was possession of the property that was in question. That case is not right on point, but you know, this is a thorny problem, but the problem, I think, can be resolved by a couple of other ways that we've mentioned, one of them in the brief, and that is that, both of them in the brief, that it was harmless error, what the judge did. The other one is, of course, that there was title by acquiescence, because the evidence showed that when the survey was done in 1957, and it was not disputed, Mrs. Howard, who testified at trial, could not remember her son, who has taken her place in the proceeding now, was too young to remember. But the survey plat was provided to Mrs. Howard in 57 with the admonition from my client's father, who was a predecessor in title, to fix your deed. What this case, and I know I'm not out of time, but...
Has he answered your question?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you. Thank you all very much.
2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Madam Clerk, 2 minutes.
Mr. Chief Justice, if I can do two things, answer a question Justice Millett asked and answer your question. Justice Millett, you posed a question, can you prepare for adequately a case for adverse possession when you assert a boundary line? And I think the answer is no. It shifts the witnesses away from what we were prepared for, surveyors and professionals coming in and saying, this is what this deed means, this is where this tree is, to bringing in friends and neighbors and saying, we farmed tobacco on it, we cut timber on it, we built a land, road on it, and those sorts of things, which didn't happen. And so I think it's a substantively different case. It's like my child asking me for a glass of milk, and later, when I give him milk, he demands apple juice. Maybe I should, as a parent, be prepared for that, but I'm not. I'm prepared for giving him milk. So different cases. Then, to answer Mr. Chief Justice's question, can they bring back a claim of adverse possession? I don't want to give away an issue of equitable estoppel or anything of that nature, but I think certainly you can file a claim for that later if you're the defendant and you want to do that. This case brought by the plaintiff was for establishing their boundary line. I think it's important to look at the case, the Bay House case, Jenkins versus Bay House, 2003. This court looked at land underneath the Chesapeake Bay, Gaskins Pond. I don't know if the court recalls that. But essentially, the plaintiff in that case alleged ground underneath the water and at trial argued to keep them off of the water. Different situation. This court said you didn't plead it. You can't rely on it. Likewise, the defendant here wants to take one thing, say the 1905 deeds in one way, and say adverse possession a different way. They're different cases. It's different stuff. What they ought to do, like they did in the Jenkins versus Bay House case, is start back over. If you don't ask, you can't get it.
Counsel, which of your assignments of error address whether the trial court erred in actually basically awarding this land to your opponent?
Mr. Chief Justice, may I answer?
Absolutely.
Last question. Justice Powell, all of the assignments of error essentially say the justice...
Say that he erred in not requiring it as an affirmative defense.
Right.
He erred in finding they put on sufficient evidence of adverse possession. But do either of those capture what's being raised here, and that is whether he could actually render the relief that he gave of establishing the line here as opposed to saying you haven't established the line?
Yes, Your Honor. The first assignment of error is the one that gets to the crux of the issue. And that is, can they invent this claim at trial without providing pre-notice and everything else and do what the judge did when he reversed himself and give them their land after he's already found in favor of the plaintiffs and found that they met their burden in the first letter opinion? And so that's the issue. And we believe that the issue of determining substantively do you have to plead it dictates whether Howard's win that land or win where they believe the land should be, or the Balls win the adverse possession claim.
Right. Thank you very much. The court is adjourned.
All rise.